Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more. My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called The Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore.
So, Dad, Michael Roseman was just saying that he thought it was pretty suspicious that we moved to MENA in the early 1980s, and you became a banker in MENA, right, when Barry Seal and what's the movie, Michael?
I don't remember the name.
American Dream.
Yeah.
American Dream.
Yep.
Yeah. With Tom Cruise
and
Bill Clinton and drugs and the airport and everything.
Yeah.
Contenistas.
Hey, man, I just don't know.
You might have had something to do with that.
I didn't say it was suspicious. What I said was I watched the movie, put two and two together, and text Brent, and I said, hey, I don't know Clay's daddy, but wasn't he a banker in MENA at this time? How many banks are in MENA? Yeah.
There were a lot when he left.
Apparently, there were a lot more when he left.
Welcome to the Bear Grease Render. Man, I've been excited about this ever since I knew who was going to be here. We have multiple newer-ish voices. I have to my left, Brent Reeves. Brent, good
yes,
to
sir.
See you, my man.
Good to be here,
I want to talk about... okay, we're going to go around the room, and I'm going to tell each of you what I would like to talk to you about.
Okay.
And then we're going to come back to you.
Thank you.
Brent, I want to talk to you about Ken's Reward. Brent's podcast this week,
Winged
he talked
Pegasus.
About a horse named Ken's Reward. We got to come back to that. To Brent's left, Isaac Neal.
Thank
Bear
you.
Bear Grease assistant to the assistant producer of Bear Grease.
Yeah.
From Missouri. From the queen city of the Ozarks. Did you know that Springfield, Missouri calls themselves the queen city
man.
Of the Ozarks?
Really?
As far as I know, King City of the Ozarks is up for grabs, so I don't know what you're grousing about. We're just saying we're the second best city in the Ozarks.
Yeah, yeah. You should call yourself the runner-up city
in
the Ozarks.
It's pretty good. There's a lot of cities in the Ozarks.
From the runner-up city in the Ozarks, Isaac Neal, to Isaac's left, Michael Roseman.
Hello.
Man, Michael, so Michael, Dad, he owns, operates... He's the engineer. He's the lead man.
Dishwasher
at Sunspot Coon Lights. So the Coon Lights that we sell on MeatEater.com that me and Brent use, the big high-powered Coon Lights, this is the man behind it.
Really?
So, yep.
Yes, sir.
Wow.
The king.
Pretty cool, man.
Yeah. And so what I want to talk to Michael about later is his new light, and I'm going to tell everyone in the United States that if you don't own one of these, you should. I use my light all the time, and I don't even have a coon dog right now. I have one retired dog that backtracks a lot. So
runs rabbits and backtracks.
It's pretty straight.
Oh.
It just we just hit a lot of den trees.
Oh.
After I lost my good female. So I use my coon light almost every day. Incredible light. I use it in the backcountry. We'll get back to that.
10-4.
The guest of honor today, because he's come so far, is my buddy Chris Powell of the Houndsman XP podcast. How far did you come today?
I traveled for 3 weary days by mule and donkey and covered wagon.
We're talking physical distance, because I thought there was personal growth or something. You've come a long way.
Yeah. There's always personal growth when you're traveling with a Yog Terrier.
Yes.
Patience.
Oh, you got tolerance. Your dog with you?
Yeah. Yeah, I got Tough with me.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yep. You came from Indiana?
Yes, I did.
Northwest Arkansas?
Yep.
Great. Well, boys, we're going to talk to Chris about this newly proposed, it's going to get serious, Colorado legislation that's designed to shut down mountain lion hunting with hounds in the state of Colorado. So Chris is he's stayed up to date on that, and we're going to introduce that and talk about it.
To the world.
We're going to come back to that. So thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, man. And then to your left, Gary Believer Newcomb. Did you hear your name come up on the podcast?
I did. And boy, you nailed it, brother.
I'm excited about this episode. It's been a while since we've done a documentary style podcast. We've been doing stories for 10 weeks.
Yep.
So, you know, if you're new to this, if this is your first ever time to tune into the Bear Grease podcast, our render is when we talk about the documentary style podcast that we do. And the last 5 episodes, we did 2 episodes, Chris, in September on Alaska stories, which just was a compilation of wild, harrowing Alaskan stories, which I really enjoyed. And then we did 3 full deer hunting episodes, which to me are some of my favorite things that we do. I just like hearing the way people think about a moment inside of their hunting career. Really, it's just like I go to these guys that I know about them, I have respect for, and I'm like, tell me your best deer story. Yeah, I really enjoy that. So, all right. Going back the other direction, Brent.
Yep.
Ken's Reward. So, Brent, on this Country Life podcast, I'm going to take a little bit of credit for a lot of the success of this Country Life.
I wish Misty was here.
Because the way this works, Dad, is Brent will be driving somewhere. He told me the story of Ken's Reward years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
And I was like, dude, you need to figure out a way to tell that story on this Country Life. So if you haven't heard it, which go back and listen to it, Brent's dad bought him a horse.
Yeah.
from a sale in Ada, Oklahoma.
Yep.
How old were you, Brent?
Oh, let's see. I would have probably in 1988. I'd have been 21.
Brent's 22 years old. His dad and his best friend go to a horse sale in Ada, Oklahoma, and get a great deal on a purebred American quarter horse that was supposedly a rodeo horse.
Yeah.
And then
He couldn't buck. They said he wouldn't buck good enough, so they made a cow horse out of him.
They wanted him for a bucking horse.
Yep.
Made him into a roping horse.
Yep. They made him into a short.
You got to hear
ranch
him
horse.
Tell the story. He did a good job of telling the story. But the whole podcast was about animal names. Like, why do we name animals the way we do? And it's a mystery why this horse was named Ken's Reward.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he ends
Until
up having
end.
A lot of trouble with the horse. Yeah.
He was not conducive to what I wanted him to do. And what I wanted him to do was be able to get on him and ride him and get off of him without having to
without
go to the
dying.
ER. Yeah. Without any type of medical personnel involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to get on a horse and go from point A to point B.
Sounds simple.
And then come back. And both of us be happy. And it didn't work out that way.
Didn't work out with Ken's Reward.
No.
Well, here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do, if y'all are in agreement with it. We're putting out an APB across the Bear Grease world. If somebody can legitimately tell us and verify where, like, who owned Kendra Ward and what the story was. All we know was that in 1988, it was bought at a horse sale in Ada, Oklahoma, and it supposedly came from Texas.
And I saw the papers. It is an absolute 100% registered American quarter horse. I saw the papers, and his name was Ken's Reward, K-E-N apostrophe S Reward.
Okay.
That was it.
Whoever can get us in touch with Ken,
yeah,
or should Ken no longer be with us, Ken?
Yeah, Ken's is, next is, to Ken.
I will give you one of these, a genuine Arkansas plot treed coonskin hat.
That's
made
a rare
by
thing
Josh
right there.
Yeah. Landbridge Spillmaker. Yeah, for a plot to tree a coon, yeah, that's rare.
I tell you what I'll do. I'll sweeten the pot. I'll throw in a Case Mini Trapper pocket knife.
Okay.
There
it's a deal. Now, it's hard to write out, like, we're not lawyers here, but it's really got to be a genuine, like, verifiable lead where we could talk to someone and get some sense of why this horse was named Ken's Reward. Any holes in this plan, Chris?
I don't see any. I'm looking at the hat. I mean, it's that coonskin cap right there is legit. We know what a mini trapper is. I mean, somebody's just got to come up with the right info.
Are there any loopholes, though, Dad? Like, could someone, like...
Liars.
yeah. I mean, but we're going to have to talk to Ken. Now, somebody had to be pretty good to pull the wool over our eyes.
Yeah, okay.
Is this Ken's Reward's reward?
That's it. Ken's Reward's
reward. You've seen the papers, right?
I have seen the papers.
And you don't need to disclose it here, but do you know how that horse was bred?
No.
Okay.
I don't.
Well,
I don't remember.
That's one of the verification things out the window right there.
I don't remember. But I'll tell you what I've thought about a million times. And I didn't have a youngin' in the world when I had that horse. Since then, I've had three. And every time I helped them with a school project that involved glue, I fantasized about me squeezing Ken out on a piece of paper.
Oh, yeah.
That's where he wound up.
Wow.
But
that's dark.
That's brother. Really saying something.
I'm just telling you, he tried to kill me.
That is pretty dark.
I feel like I'd be remiss to not point out that you're halfway to being a long hunter by the time you get that hat and that knife. You're just missing a set of buckskins and a sharp 50
cal. That is
cow.
A great, I'm glad you reminded me. That was what we're going to talk to Clay about today.
Yep.
Is me and Steve Ranella and a team at Meat Eater, and one of those team members was Randall Williams, Dr. Randall. We talked about it this week, but we've come out with an audio original. It's essentially an audio book about the long hunters, and it's available for pre-sale. Did you see that, Dad, on the internet?
Mm-mm.
Do you get on the internet much?
Yeah.
We've done a terrible job of marketing this.
He's on the internet right now.
No. This week, Meat Eater announced our audiobook called The Long Hunters, 1761 to 1775 by Steve Ranella, Clay Newcomb, narrated by Steve Ranella and Clay Newcomb. And it is never before compiled data on the long hunters. I mean, I'm serious. There has never before been this data crunched together in such a compact way. I mean, it's incredible, and it's really cool. And so you can pre-order that now through Penguin Random House, through the links that are, you know, on Meteor and stuff. But it'll come out on January 9th.
We'll put a link in the description.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about that. It was a ton of fun.
Yeah.
So basically, it's me and Steve Ranella kind of going back and forth in this audio book.
Yep.
And really cool. So
I can tell you one thing about the internet is every time I even turn around, Brent Reeves comes up going, "This Country Life." And I'm going, "Brent, back off, man." I mean, I got to look for yours. I mean, I got to go, come on, Clay, I need to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there's
You mean
Brent.
On the Bear Grease feed?
Yeah. I just, you know, when I go after it, this guy's got the product. He's playing it.
I've got a face
a whole
for
lot
radio.
Better than you.
That's what it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, they're feeding you Brent Reeves.
Come on.
Yeah. Michael, tell us about your new light. So, well, let me go back. I already said it before, but I have been in multiple showdowns with big game hunters that thought they had a good light.
Never lost, did you?
Never.
Mm-mm, you won't.
Coon hunters win the light game every time. Am I right, Chris?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for real, I've been in hunting camps and been like, somebody shine their light, and I'd be like, that's a cute light.
That's right.
And they're like, oh, this is the best light ever. And I'll step outside and shine them. And the thing, coon hunters don't have the market on much. Let me put it that way. The one thing coon hunters have the market on is bright lights that last a long time. And I use my sunspot light all the time. I take it on backcountry hunts. I take it off my hard hat. So I have a hard hat. I've had some people ask me about why the hard hat. You don't have to use a hard hat. The idea of a hard hat is that it holds a heavier light, which the bigger coon lights, I mean, they're heavier than like a little, you know, Energizer Bunny little bitty pocket light you put in your pocket. It's a little bigger than that, but they last forever and incredibly bright. How, let me ask you this, on the lowest power of a sunspot, like the lowest walking light power, so this light would have multiple stages of brightness and even it dishes the light out different. Like it has a spotlight, but it also has a walking light. If you turned it on just the lowest walking light, how long would that light burn on a big charge?
Over 100 hours.
So you could literally leave it on in your bag for a week. 4 days.
Yeah.
4 days.
Four or five days, yeah.
I mean, that's pretty incredible.
What about candle power? Do you still use candle power, or is there some other?
So, yeah, they do, but it's the lux is what we go lux. By. Yeah, so a lot of people that look at lights, the first question they ask you is how many lumens does it have? And that's not really a measurement that's useful for us. Lumens is a measurement that comes from the factory. So it's how much that LED can output with this much current put on it. And that's total light. That's light that's lost in the reflector, light that you're never going to see. It's not something that's useful, but that's what the standard...
Oh, so lumens is not reality. Lumens...
It is, but not in the way that we use it.
Okay.
So, but that's the way that the industry in like Walmart and the smaller little stuff, that's they advertise lumens because that can be verified.
Gotcha.
So I have a Cree LED... It has this much current put to it. Cree says you have this many lumens.
Okay.
Lux, like you're talking about candle power, is how much throw that light has. So how far it's going to shine. And that's what we call brightness.
So you could have two LEDs with the same lumens, but if you put a different reflector on there.
Yes, it's like the optic that you use.
So the lux is more of a real world, lux how much light you have.
Throw of the light. Lumens is actually how much light you have coming out of it. But there's no way to measure that. What he's saying is, depending on the optics that you use for it, you can have 1,000 lux. These light bulbs. Or lumens, I'm sorry. These light bulbs have a high lumen value to them, and they just softly light up your room. So it doesn't do you any good coon hunting. But you put an optic behind it that can gather all that light and put it in one place for you, and that's what we're calling lux.
Okay. Yeah.
Finally. I've been using these lights forever, and I have heard him talk about this 1,000 times.
And you understand
finally understand it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a throwback on that is I was headed across 40, and boom, there's a nightlight. Store off the I squealed tires getting off the road because when I started hunting, nightlight was it. They came out with a 6-volt gel cell, and then I had one of those for a while, and then they put the strobe on it, and it I don't know that it did a
nothing.
Anything.
It doesn't do anything.
But it was cool to have.
The strobe was designed to make a coon look at your eyes. So you clicked it and it...
So you push the button on top of the rheostat and boom, it'd start flashing and you think, he's going to look now. The only thing it did was melt your rheostat down and start smoking on your side.
The nightlight was the first real coon hunting light I ever had. The only thing I had before that, we carried a truck battery in a backpack with this giant spotlight that they used to make that was called a sunspot.
Really?
That's where the name of the game warden took it from me.
But that's another story.
That's another story. Dad, you bought me a nightlight when I was in the 9th grade.
Yeah.
We used to have those big belts. You used to have to carry a battery pack. So you had those big, thick belts. I still got it. It was the industry standard back in the day, but now the lights are way better, way brighter, way smaller, way lighter.
The only thing in this world that is increased in functionality and quality and decreased in price is a Kuhn
Wow. Yeah. Now there's a sale for you.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I used to pay $400, $500, $600 for some of these belt lights, and they were literally maybe a fifth as bright as what we do now. Right. And you're paying $300 for a light now that lasts longer, is brighter. So
you can signal a space shuttle with
your light.
Oh, yeah.
And now this is not like a sales pitch. There's people, and I'm one of those people, that if I like something, I'll talk to people on the street about it. I'll be like, I want you to like it.
You got a minute to talk about Kuhn hunting lights?
If you don't like it, I'm offended. Like, I'm like, well, golly, man. No, Kuhn lights is one of them. And there's a lot of good Kuhn light brands. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of them. I'm just talking about Kuhn lights, but Michael's got his. Your light has a lifetime warranty.
Yeah.
Send it to you.
$10 for return shipping, and that's it. It's only incredible. Thing we don't cover is damage, and we cover that most of the time.
Yeah,
depending on how bad
it
is.
I mean, so this is not a throwaway deal.
You ever find yourself
Sunspot's considered one of the top lights in the
in the
country and in my community for sure.
Yeah,
you ever find yourself just putting on the helmet to go out to grocery shop or something just so you have an entry point for
in the middle of the day?
Break the ice.
When you're on a competition coon hunt, tell me if this is right or wrong.
I know where you're headed.
When you're on a competition coon hunt and you stop at a gas station and you got four guys in a cast in a cab of a truck, maybe you know them, maybe you don't, and you go to a gas station, everybody wears their coon light into the gas station.
That's not right.
It's usually because is that where you thought I was going to go?
Well, kind
of. Okay.
Kind
of.
I've done that multiple times. You leave the house hunting or whatever, and you got to stop at the gas station, get a pop, get a can of chew, whatever. And you got your hip boots on and your Kuhn light on, your vest on, and people are looking at you like, what is he doing? I didn't know we had coal mining around.
Justified it is somehow when you're in a competition hunt, like, it's okay. Like, if I went to Walmart, I'd just walk in there with my
chaps, man.
And my big light on. But where did you think I was going, Chris?
Oh, that was it. Yeah, the gas station store, for sure. Yeah, but, for sure.
Kuhn lights. So y'all came out with a new Copperhead.
Yeah, we come out with a new light. We dropped two nights ago. It's called the Copperhead. Comparable to our other lights, it's brighter, smaller, lighter weight than our Viper, which was our top end light.
Yeah,
smaller than the Viper, lighter weight, brighter, all the same functions.
I love it, man.
A slick looking light.
I like it. Okay, we're just marching around here, Chris.
Yeah,
I'm on a mission, man. I want to talk about this story. Of the plots.
I wore my shirt for you.
Yeah, he's got the American Plot Association shirt on.
It was either this one or not a game warden t-shirt.
Yeah. Dad, Chris is a retired game warden.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good.
I talked to one of our mutual friends.
Right, Brent?
Yeah, exactly.
They're awesome.
I should have left that game warden
I talked
story
to one
out.
Of our mutual friends just yesterday, Chris. And, no. You told me this story.
Maybe.
One of our mutual friends
introduced
you when you went bear hunting with them in East Tennessee. He would introduce you as, this is Chris Powell. He's a former game warden from Indiana.
Oh, yeah.
And Chris kind of got embarrassed about it, like saying, hey, you don't have to say that. And the guy was like, trust me, I don't want these guys to find out later that you are a former game warden. He said they won't trust you. Is that about the way it happened?
That's exactly the way it happened. You know, it's like, since when do we have to walk around and this is Clay Newcomb. He works at Meat Eater. This is Gary Newcomb. He was a retired banker. You know, it's like, oh, this is a game warden and we're going to introduce him like that. It's like being a preacher. You know, I never introduced my preacher. It's like, hey, this is so-and-so. He's my preacher. I mean, it's like sending out the warning.
Yeah.
Don't drink a beer. Don't cuss. Don't tell any off-color jokes. So, yeah, I used to get introduced like that.
Yeah.
A lot.
He was doing it as a favor to you, though.
I think he was really good at pivoting on the moment and coming up with that. But I do think it was for his benefit.
Yeah, yeah.
That he wasn't bringing a game warden to the mountain.
He's like, just full disclosure here.
Yeah, full disclosure.
Yeah, full disclosure. Yeah.
You know, some of my favorite Bear Grease stories were about game wardens.
Yeah.
I mean, they just go down as the top-notch stories, man. I loved them.
Yeah, yeah. That seems to be the consensus of the world.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
some of our best episodes were Louis Dell and Charlie and then the Secret Agent Man
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, Secret Agent. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
As a parent, nothing keeps me up at night more than the idea of something happening to my children. But if something happens to me and I'm not around to protect them, that's a true nightmare. Having term life insurance for myself is crucial because I can rest easier knowing my children and loved ones can have some financial support even if I'm not there. That's where Fabric by Gerber Life comes in. Having life insurance just gives me that extra confidence throughout the day, knowing that my family will be financially cared for if something bad happened to me. Fabric by Gerber Life is term life insurance you can get done right here, right now. You can be covered from your couch in under 10 minutes with no health exam required. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/bear. That's meetfabric.com/bear. M-E-E-T, fabric.com/bear. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company. Not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Whitetail Institute launched the food plot revolution in 1988 with a concentration on research and real-world testing of forage products specifically for whitetail deer. Whitetail Institute's research and development team of agronomy experts provide effective, personalized service. I've been using Imperial Whitetail Clover for a long time in a food plot back behind my house. In 2007, I killed the biggest buck of my life over an Imperial Whitetail Clover small quarter-acre food plot. Imperial Whitetail Clover is the only clover scientifically developed through years of selective breeding. Clover Extreme genetic stability provides extreme cold tolerance, disease, and drought tolerance. It really does. Clover is coated with Whitetail Institute's Rain Bond, a polymer coating added for enhanced seedling survivability. They have an exclusive offer for Bear Grease listeners, 15% off Imperial Clover when you use the code BEAR at WhitetailInstitute.com. That's WhitetailInstitute.com and use code BEAR for 15% off.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater.
Chris, tell it. Give us like a high-level view of what's going on in Colorado.
Yeah, so we're going to get serious, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what's happening. We're seeing science-based responsible wildlife management being hijacked in the state of Colorado through what's called Initiative 91. And it's been introduced. It went through the what's called the title board hearing where they've got to make sure that the labeling is right. And Initiative 91 is going to be a ballot initiative where the public gets to vote on this issue of wildlife management, and it pertains directly to mountain lions and bobcats, and they threw in lynx for sensational value. You can't hunt lynx in the lower 48 anyway, because they're on the endangered species list.
Are there lynx in Colorado?
There are lynx in Colorado.
Really?
So they just threw that one on the pile just to add to the sensationalism, even though you still can't hunt them.
So you can't hunt them now.
No, you can't hunt them now. So why does that need to be there, you know?
Yeah,
because it's an animal on the endangered species list that when the people are voting,
look
it up, they can say, oh, yeah, we definitely won't let them hunt.
It's totally,
drama. Yeah.
Totally sensationalized. But what's happened is some groups have gotten together in Colorado and put this on the or put this forward, have got approval for it to be moving forward and be introduced to the ballot next year. So they've still got to go through signature acquisition and things like that. Right now it's in the Supreme Court, and basically that's just making sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed and things like that. But the most alarming thing about it is not because of the lions and the bobcat issue. I mean, take those two animals out and put elk in there, or put sheep in there, or put, you know, whatever animal you want, white-tailed deer in there. This is just a typical tactic where people with influence are trying to hijack the traditional North American model for wildlife conservation and make it a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start doing that, there's a lot of dangers and a lot of trip ups for that. You know, we don't necessarily need somebody who's uninformed, who's been sensationalized to and had this narrative sold to them based on emotion to vote on this. You know, because it's just alarming. It's an alarming thing. I mean, our wildlife is, and our story of our conservation story is amazing. You know, going back to the 1880s and the recovery and the money that was spent to, and it's all because hunters stepped up and said, we'll do this.
Right.
And then the first tenet of the North America model is wildlife is a public trust. So right. We did that and we said, yeah, go to the park and look at elk. Go to the national forest and look at bears. Do all this other stuff. So we willingly did that. It's the only bill that I'm aware of that was ever passed, the Pittman-Robertson bill that was ever passed, where people said, tax us.
Yeah.
Please tax us. So we've got a big investment in this thing, and the anti-hunting crowd is trying to flip the narrative and divert us away from science-based and responsible wildlife management, make it a political weapon, and base
and,
it on
and
emotion.
It's, who is doing this?
There are a couple local groups in Colorado that are leading the charge on this.
Yeah.
That it hasn't been revealed yet, but we're pretty confident that there are some larger, more well-funded groups that are backing
this. I heard
that
they've got a lot of money and are waiting. I mean, this is a very well-funded thing for Initiative 91. Is that correct?
That's yet to be seen. You're talking which side?
Well, not our side.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to – tell me the timeline. So when – give me a timeline of, like, when are they signing the – well, I don't know what I'm asking.
Right now it's been introduced to go to the Colorado Supreme Court.
Okay,
and that's expected to be heard sometime in January to make sure all the legalities and, you know,
the law works. Yeah, and then
the constitutionality
of it. When
does it
go to the people to vote on?
Yeah. When does it go?
When does it?
Yeah, next November in the 2024 election.
Okay.
So between that time, you're going to have a period of time where you're going to have signatures to make sure they meet the ballot requirements for the required number of signatures for it to appear on a ballot.
Yeah.
There are going to be lawsuits. There's going to be a campaign time when both sides of we as hunters are going to launch a campaign. The anti-hunters are going to launch a campaign. We're going to have this clash of titans in the state of Colorado all through next summer. And then leading up to the election, we need to have our ducks in a row by July, I would say, to be able to start working on
who
this.
Who is the main guy? What's the guy's name that we were talking about?
Yeah, the guy that's spearheading the whole efforts out there is Dan Gates, and he is the head of an organization called Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management.
Yeah.
And a lot of different entities are coming together to back him, and he's been working this state for 30 years.
We knew
this
was coming.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Colorado's ripe for it. It's
yeah.
The demographics there are right.
Big yeah. urban cities with most of the population, and then
to give you an idea, I saw a slide on that that was put together in a presentation while I was out in Colorado a month or so ago. There are 5.8 million people in the state of Colorado. 5.2 million of those live on the Front Range and then Denver, Boulder, that metroplex.
Yeah.
5.2 million. That leaves 600,000 people living out in the sticks that understand ranching, wildlife management, yeah. and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's going to be it is the battleground state for wildlife management
in 2024. Yeah.
There is no place hotter.
You'll be hearing more stuff from us and some specific calls to action at different times. But yeah, we're going to do our best Bear Grease and Meat Eater to get the word out. And because, I mean, people that are listening to this podcast are going to know why we're against and, you know, closing down the season and why we're for predator management.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I wouldn't even try to pigeonhole it as a predator management. This is an outright attack on science-based wildlife management.
Yeah, yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
And not just the predator control. So from what I understand, and I don't big game hunt with hounds, but from what I understand, the cat hunters are basically responsible for saving mountain lions.
That's a great point, because if you were not for the houndsmen that were out there catching mountain lions, organizations like Colorado's Parks and Wildlife would not be able to collect the data. There's so much that goes into a mountain lion study. You know, you catch it, you dart it, you collar it, you can collect all that data, you can find out their home ranges, you can find their kills on ungulate species. You take the bones from those ungulate species back into the lab, you can measure the fat, you can test their DNA, you can the predator management studies are an integral part and valuable to the management of all wildlife species.
Yeah, and it just the general idea too that a hunted animal has cultural value, and where an animal has cultural value, it will ultimately be protected by the people that want to hunt it.
Always.
And so, you know, there's nobody in Colorado that wants more mountain lions than mountain lion hunters.
You got that right.
I mean, but we also know that predator numbers, what's happening continental wide is that predator numbers are on the rise. Mm-hmm. I mean, wolves, mountain lions, coyotes, coons, possums, the meso bears. Predators, black bears, like everything is those are the things that seem to be doing really well right now. Mm-hmm. And so hunting with hounds is a management tool, highly regulated. It is not out of control. Mountain lions are doing incredibly well in Colorado.
They're not
threatened. And so this is a political thing of someone that doesn't like the idea of people going out and hunting mountain lions. This is something that's been going on for hundreds of years. And I mean, people hunting with dogs have been going on for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. But, you know, mm-hmm. You get the point. So, man, everybody's always heard me talk about guarding the gate. It's been a while since I've actually talked about it, so I'll quickly review the doctrine. I believe, and a lot of people believe, that the whole model of North American wildlife, our management system, the weak link, the place where the anti-hunting community really has a strong foothold, is inside of the predator arena, specifically bears and mountain lions. It's harder for them to sell to the general public that hunting a deer or hunting a squirrel or hunting a whatever is bad. It's a pretty easy sell for them to say, hey, these guys are out there killing bears and mountain lions. What are they even doing with them? It's a trophy hunt. They don't eat them. All the stuff that's not true.
Correct.
I believe that weakest link in this whole system is the place that we need to guard the most. There kind of was, like, I would say 10 years ago, by my interpretation of the hunting community, there was kind of this idea that those guys are kind of on the fringe, and those guys being the predator hunters and specifically the hound hunters that are bear hunting with hounds, and those guys are kind of on the fringe. That's kind of going away. We're not going to associate with that. Like, people weren't wanting to step up and talk. And that's not entirely true. That's a generalization, hyperbolic, as they say, exaggeration to make a point. But that was, I felt like that was happening. And then we were like, hey, the weakest link is the most important thing.
Yep.
Because once they get that, we know this is not exaggerated hype political talk, like incrementalization, like the anti-hunting community, and whether it's this big, really designed thing. I mean, they're kind of like, you know, it's like they got a 100-year plan to stamp this thing out. Yeah, they've even said it.
You can't compromise. You can't give up one inch.
Yeah,
because it will not satisfy them.
Yeah,
you can't say okay.
Yeah,
we'll just do this, and that'll be the end of it.
Yeah,
but it won't be the end of it.
There is nothing that they do that is not with intent. Everything they do is purpose driven. It's the reason they came to Colorado is because of the population dynamics there. And
right.
And
they the felt reason, like they could win.
The reason they come after mountain lions is because it mainly affects houndsmen. And so houndsmen historically have been very loosely organized.
Yeah.
Very, even like you alluded to, being looked at on the fringe. I mean, you can't even get bear hunters or anybody to come together to say that, all of them to say that, hey, man, you guys are hunting with hounds, go for it. You know, we even get sniped from inside the hunting community.
Yeah.
So.
But I think that's changing.
Yes, I do too.
Yeah.
I 100% believe that. I think we're gaining a lot of ground there. So it was just go back to the art of, you know, art of war with Sun Tzu. These people know what they're doing, and they're coming after the weakest link.
Yeah.
And what we need from the hunting community as a whole is, like Brent said, that we stand together and we say, no. It's like, you know, it's like a family reunion. You don't get along with everybody there.
Yeah.
But if somebody comes up and punches your cousin in the face that you don't like, you're throwing in.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what we need.
Well, and that's what I think we've seen in the last 7-8 years is more of the general hunting community coming around the hound and predator community and saying, hey, this is a big part. This is a part of the family, and we're concerned. Because what we've always said is that if you're a deer hunter in Missouri, if you're a turkey hunter, if you're, you know, this matters to you. Like if the whole of North American hunting, and we don't realize that we're in the heyday of so many parts of North American hunting. I mean, we have this incredible thing. And the trend, and you see it in other places in the world, is that thing, that freedom slips away and goes away. And so, you know, we're saying, hey, we're a generation that is not going to give anything. Now, we're not trying to be hard-nosed or jerks about it. I mean, we're just saying, hey, this is just who we are. As Americans, there is a place inside of our society where the hunters reside. You don't have to be a hunter. We love wildlife. If you, in general, people in America love wildlife and wild places. Well, guess who does too? The hunters. We're the ones who are funding wildlife, habitat, conservation across the country. We're all on the same team. You want hunters. Hunters provide an incredible, incredible service to society. We need mountain lion hunters. We need bear hunters. And so that's why this is important. Because the idea would be like, well, I don't hunt mountain lions in Colorado. I probably never will. I don't care. That's a short-sighted thing, mm-hmm. You know. So it's longer term. And I mean, that's really all there is to say about it.
We have this generation of hunters has inherited 150 years of conservation work.
Right.
I mean, you think about that. We are the benefactors of Teddy Roosevelt and
all these guys that had a lot worse than us.
You know, all these guys that built this, and now we're enjoying it all. And it's like, I'm a deer hunter and I got my pile. I'm an elk hunter and I got my pile. I'm a houndsman and I got my pile. Man, we're not going to survive like that. We got to find ways to bridge those gaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. None of us can stand alone.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is all really great, and it's just an invitation for the whole hunting community to rally around this thing.
Can I tell people where to find more information
absolutely.
And updates?
Yep.
So if you go to SaveTheHuntColorado.org,
okay,
then you can get updates on what's going on with Initiative 91. You can also go to our website at HoundsmanXP.com. You know, scroll. We're dropping a lot of content on this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, just reach out to me if you're concerned about it and you're looking. Say, man, this is a good fight. I want to get in it. Just contact me through our website at HoundsmanXP.com.
And there's a bunch of groups that are going to be doing a lot.
Absolutely.
I'm a big fan of Howl.org. The guys at Howl.
I think they're working on it.
I think they're doing a good job of getting stuff out.
Blood Origins.
Blood Origins is another one.
All these groups. I mean, Sportsman's Alliance, big time.
Yes. I'm glad you brought them up.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
But CRWM is going to be the place that we need to get this money to. So that's where I would tell you to go first. Go
Who
to CRWM.
Has the bigger army? I mean, if you just say this is war,
you know, it's
U.S. versus China, who's the probable winner?
Well, I think if you're talking funding, then I believe that the anti-hunting crowd is got more dedicated funds to fight this today. However, if you look at the amount of money that hunting produces, then that's one of the biggest thing that your person that's a non-hunter that's got to make a decision in Colorado, who's going to fund this wildlife? Next year, if we outlaw it this year, who's going to fund it next year? It's not going to be the Humane Society of the United States or Center for Biological Diversity or Friends of Mountain Lions or whoever is behind this. You know, you're going to strip the funding mechanism to the tune of about $3.5 billion a day.
You know, if you can communicate the way y'all have communicated, I mean, you win. But you've got a gullible populace out there that could care less about it.
Right,
they just read it and go, hey, that sounds like a good idea. I would be one of them.
Well,
I'd look at that 5 minutes. I'd go, yeah, man, get rid of it.
Well, that's one of their tactics.
So you got to be, I mean, they're lying to
the
public.
They tried to push this thing through with sensational narrative, like talking about trophy hunting.
Yeah.
Well, Clay, you do an outstanding job of defending trophy hunting. I mean, I've watched you do it on Joe Rogan. I mean, you turned it around on Rogan and explained it to him.
Yeah.
But that's part of it. And that language has been taken off of it. But they're trying to redefine what hunting actually is. And that's the most important thing that affects all hunters.
Yeah. Well, there's gonna be a whole lot more coming about it, but that's the business. This is a boardroom. That was the business we needed to take care of. And thanks for giving us the details, Chris.
Yeah, as well as I could.
Yeah, that we're going to have a lot more about that kind of stuff.
You know, whenever I look at pictures of my kids from the past year or even just a few months ago, I'm so amazed at how fast they're growing up. And then it hits me hard. I'm getting older, too. That's why planning for my family's financial security has become a top priority. Making sure we're prepared and having enough life insurance in case something unexpected happens and I'm out of the picture is crucial. And Fabric by Gerber Life makes it simple to get the protection that's right for your family. Fabric by Gerber Life was designed by parents and for parents to help you get a high-quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. There's no risk to apply. They have a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/bear. That's M-E-E-T. fabric.com/bear, meetfabric.com/bear. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Whitetail Institute launched the food plot revolution in 1988 with a concentration on research and real-world testing of forage products specifically for whitetail deer. Whitetail Institute's research and development team of agronomy experts provide effective, personalized service. I've been using Imperial Whitetail Clover for a long time in a food plot back behind my house. In 2007, I killed the biggest buck of my life over an Imperial Whitetail Clover small quarter-acre food plot. Imperial Whitetail Clover is the only clover scientifically developed through years of selective breeding. Clover Extreme genetic stability provides extreme cold tolerance, disease, and drought tolerance. It really does. Clover is coated with Whitetail Institute's Rain Bond, a polymer coating added for enhanced seedling survivability. They have an exclusive offer for Bear Grease listeners, 15% off Imperial Clover when you use the code BEAR at WhitetailInstitute.com. That's WhitetailInstitute.com and use code BEAR for 15% off.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater.
The podcast, Pure Americana. Let me start off by saying, Chris would understand this. This is a pretty risky podcast, Dad.
Really?
I mean, to
oh yeah, I understand that.
I didn't challenge anything, but to even put out there that there was some skepticism around the origin story. But I did it because I actually felt like it would be fair to the origin story to do that.
What's next? Rewrite the Bible, Clay?
This is so beneficial to the plot hound.
Yeah.
Origins and everything. I mean, they just took a little area like this and exploded it all through Bear Grease. People are going to buy books. People are going to talk about this. You know, Clay's been foreshadowing what a great podcast he's got coming up. And I turned it on. I thought, dadgum plot hounds.
You thought, I don't care about plot hounds.
But, I mean, it was an awesome deal. And I tell you, it was really good. And I think everybody will really enjoy it. It was a big deal, just like you said. But at first glance, a plot hound, man. I don't need no stinking plot hound. But
well,
now
now you want one. It's a human story. A family story. Yeah. It's a history story.
I don't think you offended anybody.
Well, what I'm saying is in the plot community, like people are so opinionated and so just it's they get attached to a narrative and they sometimes wouldn't want to hear anything else. But yeah, Brent, should I die a mysterious, strange death, will you lead an expedition into the Great Smoky Mountains?
I already got the team picked out. We're ready. I can't tell you that.
Yeah. Chris, what did you think? What was like the most, now this is all stuff you'd be very familiar with. You hunt plots.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Plot historian though. I thought your selection of having Bob Plott, who is a descendant of the Plott family, yeah, who's heard these stories his whole life.
Yeah.
And he's dove into, you know, finding out the stories.
For his books. There's a book I'm holding it, Strike and Stay, Strike the and Story Stay. Of the Plot Hound. It really is a fascinating book. Bob's a real pro when it comes to history. And the coolest thing about this book is all the photos. You got to look at that, Brant.
I'm going to get it.
It's
It needs to be in every houndsman, every hunter's collection, really.
Look,
I mean,
look, this just is, look at some of those pictures.
And then John Jackson. John Jackson has been writing plot history for decades, you know, and very well spoken. I really like the way you described him, a true Southern mountain gentleman.
Yeah.
And that's that describes John to a T.
Yeah. He was, that was the first time I'd met John. I knew John and had communicated with him some with Bear Hunting Magazine. He had written some stuff for us, but he is like a classic Highland Southern gentleman. Mm-hmm. That's the way I described him. Just very proper, very articulate, but deeply passionate. Like we went down, and I recorded a bunch of this stuff, but I just wasn't able to really use it in the podcast. But the basement in his house is like a museum with plot stuff and just Appalachian rural stuff and Civil War stuff and guns and famous plot hunters over there, guys that had plots. He was instrumental in finding some kind of relics of the plot community. Anyway, just such a neat guy, but knew so much. But he's not a believer, and that's what's kind of radical.
I was disappointed.
What's that?
I was disappointed.
You were disappointed, but like John, like he said, I hate to disappoint you.
Oh, yeah, I was disappointed.
He was melancholy when he talked about it, too.
Okay, here's the deal. I've read Bob Plott's book, A New Bob Plott. I'd heard the story from, actually, Steve Hurd is the one who introduced me to the original story. Steve Hurd is a breeder of a strain of plots called Bluff Creek Plots. It's the kind of dogs I've hunted. And Steve was the first one that ever introduced me to plots, really. And he told me the story, just like on a phone call. He's like,
Johannes,
this is years ago.
Stepping off the Mayflower.
Yeah, about the two brothers. One of them dies. They bring five dogs. Three of them are brindle. Two of them are yellow, whatever. And I was like, wow, that's incredible. When I go to John Jackson, who is a plot historian, I go to his house and I expect him to just tell me that story. And he immediately, he did such a good job. He was like, Johannes Plott, da da da. He just like fed me. And then he goes, Clay, I hate to disappoint you, but I don't think that happened. And I was like, crushed. Literally, I was like, oh gosh. I mean, for real, I didn't know what to do with the, I was like, well, what am I supposed to do with this interview now that this whole story that I thought was true maybe isn't true?
Well, I think there's one big point here that I found fascinating about the whole podcast, and that is I'm less interested in what was true in terms of a historical sense and more interested in the fact that there was one family that cared enough about this thing to hand down this tradition from one generation to the next.
Yeah.
Like, the veracity of the story down to the detail is less interesting to me than to zoom out and go, like, here's this family that cared enough about this thing that whether or not the origin story of a guy stepping off a boat with five dogs is true, they are the genesis of this breed.
Yeah.
And it is because it's almost more compelling that it's not this happenstance thing of a guy, or maybe it is, you know, but it's not this happenstance thing of a guy stepping off with five dogs and here we go. It's this very careful, over time, each father to son, uncle to nephew, whatever, telling this story, caring about these dogs, bringing this forward.
Yeah.
That's as compelling, if not more compelling to me.
And that's
like,
what John Jackson said. He was like, he basically said the story, you know, either way, even the story, if that didn't happen, he said it is as compelling as the original narrative.
Yeah.
But and I mean, we're kind of cutting right to the chase here, but if that story was just completely fabricated, it happened very quickly because Bob Plott, his third great grandfather, would have been Johannes or George Plott, third great grandfather. So not his dad, but his, you know, like you start going back and it's like not very far.
Yeah.
And somebody in that line created a really wild story and cemented it into the plot community. I mean, most plot people wouldn't even question that story. Am I right?
Right.
In the same way that our last conversation was a conversation about, like, to some degree, like, what are humans? Like, when we're having these conversations about conservation and wildlife management, we want to remove humans from that system, right? But that's a luxury that's only happened in the last 150 to 200 years. We're a part of the system. Us growing up in this world and learning to hunt, learning to interact with animals, we're an integral part of the system. We're not a different system that's removed.
Not following you.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's serious. Is anybody following what this? He's talking Chinese over here.
I never know what Isaac's talking about.
The evolution and the progress of man is integral with hunting.
Yeah, yeah.
The species we hunt, we're a part of that same system. We're not a different system. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's exactly right. And that's what the anti-hunters tried to tell us,
right,
is that we're not part of that system when
that's
we
only
are.
A narrative that's developed right. in the last 150, 200 years because we've had the luxury to be removed from it. Mm-hmm. And in the same way...
What's this got to do with plots?
I'm bringing it back.
You better hurry up.
Hey, the only thing that's standing in the way from me tying this together is you. In the same way, we look at oral narratives, oral histories...
There we go.
And we look down on them. We are like, oh, well, that's not reliable because it was oral. And it's like,
that is
the story of humanity.
Yeah.
The only way we gave our histories for the last millennia preceding us is an oral history. The only reason we have anything at all. And so I think it is a very modern viewpoint to look at an oral tradition and go, well, that's not reliable.
Show me a piece of paper.
That really was the
head-to-head conflict.
And
how much weight does a oral story carry versus what was on a piece of paper on a cargo manifest.
And
from
Chris can tell you, from a law enforcement perspective, before all these crazy CSI shows came on TV, how good was an eyewitness then who just saw something?
Oh, yeah.
Pretty reliable.
And then you had dash cams, and then you had to have dash cam.
Then you had to have fingerprints, DNA, and all that, and a man's word is just tossed
out. That's a good point. So maybe back in the 30s, nobody would have even been asking these questions.
Even in the early 90s, before DNA and all this other stuff, you watch, getting back to what Brent said, when a police officer took a stand and he testified to something, he had credibility in the courtroom, and the defense attorney's job was to discredit this law enforcement officer. And so that's why, and I know Brent's heard this, they'll sit there and they'll say, instead of saying Officer Reeves, they'll say Mr. Reeves.
Yeah.
They'll try to discredit him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that has to do with what we're talking about, but
I see what you're saying, Brent. Is that like, what more do we need? I mean, again, this idea of a head-to-head between the actual data and facts that we have, which are important and we need, and then an oral story. Because what's compelling is that this Plott family, very quick, what we do know 100% is that George Plott had a bunch of dogs that were unique to this part of the world, and he just came straight from Germany. What do you think, Michael?
Is there any documentation of a brindle hound in Germany?
Yeah, there is. There's a Hanover. Okay, that's a good point. There is a breed of dog called Hanoverian hounds, which there is some brindle and dachshunds too, I'm told.
Okay, I got a few questions here.
Okay.
How do you spell Johannes?
Like Johannes.
Okay, like
with
J-O-H-A-N-N-E-S. Yeah.
Okay, so that...
Oh, now I'm going to get on to Michael. What does this have to do?
What did you say when you... What, anglicized? What's
anglicized.
The word?
Anglicized. Yeah.
All right, that would be anglicized to John, not George.
Well, we're not arguing that. You have to take that up with the plots.
Well, I know, and I'm not going to tell anybody their family story because I don't really have a clue. I'm just, this is just my mind. If someone asks a question, this is where I'm going to go to. It was signed G-Plot.
G-Plot.
Not J-Plot.
Right.
All right, so Johannes probably wasn't the name on the boat.
Right, right. And I mean, that's what John Jackson says.
Yeah, it was probably George. How does a boy that's by himself, that his brother just died, land in a country where he has no money and no possessions and take care of five dogs and keep them alive all that
Well,
way.
But see, we don't have any story.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know if there's more to the story I'm not hearing.
Right.
Or where this goes. In my opinion, let me ask you this too.
They might kill you. You know that, right?
They don't know where I live.
I'll tell them.
Gary, where's the Newcombs from?
England.
I mean, England? Okay.
Negative.
Scotland. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think they come from somewhere other than Scotland?
What do you mean?
What I mean is before they got to Scotland, were they somewhere else?
Yeah, probably. They came from somewhere.
The moon, I think.
You can't make these dogs out here sane, from what I know from dog breeding, out of five dogs.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So there is so much in the any hound, not just plot. You're calling them Americana. The same things with walker dogs, blue ticks, anything else. They got their body shape, their overall makeup from English hounds. Okay. Right. Long ears.
European hounds.
Yeah. Everything else was American. There's no telling how much of that.
Well, the thing that's different about a plot than any other breed of the hounds is they are different. They're a different style of dog.
Style, but if you just look at them, they're a hound.
No, that's not true.
You don't think so?
No, their ears are shorter. More of a flag tail in a traditional. I do not believe, because the Appalachian people are way too pragmatic to not breed the five. They're not pure. If old Shep was a good bear dog, this dog that I'm calling a plot's getting bred to old
Which
Shep.
Which makes them Americana, but that was my point. Yeah. This same thing happened in blue ticks, English, walkers.
What same thing? Clarify.
They were bred to curs. They were bred to whatever. Okay. The best squirrel dog I've ever seen in my life was half Labrador and half Chow. No kind of hound whatsoever. Absolute tree and machine.
And you're saying that could have been
there may be a little bit of German something in those dogs, but these hounds came, what was mixed into them come from Native Americans. They come from the Appalachian people that were already here.
Yeah.
And I don't see a difference in the plot story and walkers or black and tans.
Well, but okay, I could shoot some holes in that boat.
Walkers
in that photo right there look just like the walkers in your kennel.
That's because
That's
because they chose a color to breed to. Because walker dogs started out as English dogs.
Okay.
They were the same dogs as blue ticks, the same dogs as red ticks.
That's right.
And they chose that color pattern and bred for that color.
I hear what you're saying, but you're not making your point very clear.
Yeah.
Just give me one sentence.
The overall thing.
You're saying
is
that they came from dogs that were
all
here.
All of those hounds are Americana. Every one of them. They all have the same story. The difference in them is that the plot hounds has one particular family that they go back to.
Right. Okay.
The rest of them are overall, but the story of them is all the exact same.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Why does the plot, and I see what you're saying about the shape of a hound. I mean, I could give you that. They're shaped about like a hound, but all blue ticks and even, I mean, the brindle is different than any other English hound. Where'd that come from?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I got a French bulldog that's brindle.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Where that probably come from the mixing of all these other dogs into that.
Yeah.
That were not hounds, but had the traits that they were looking for. Like I told you, had a lab and a chow that would tree.
Yeah.
So they were pragmatic. They would have took anything that would have improved their dogs and put that in
there.
So
there's a case, and I said it when I talked about, and I'm not sure I used the correct term by saying that brindle was a recessive gene inside of all dogs, but I mean, there are brindle boxers, there are brindle feist. My little feist out here is brindle plots, brindle pit bulls.
Mm-hmm.
Like, brindle is something, and that was my buddy who's a big time plot man, is the one who brought that up to me. He was like, Clay, if you just mix a bunch of dogs together, it's not long before you have a bunch of brindle. What say you to this, Chris?
I think you can mix a lot of blue ticks together and you're never going to get brindle.
Okay. I like it.
So I think there was a brindle means something. Yeah. It was a concentration from the plot family. I latch on because I am a romantic and a historian and I like the story of Johannes Plot and that story. I think he probably came here with the intent of being a gameskeeper, you know, following his father's trade back in Germany. He was probably an indentured servant at the time, so he already had a place to go. He didn't need money. Mm. Somebody picked him up off that boat and brought him down there, and he had some dogs with him. And after he worked off his indentured servitude, he was also a man of means, you know, from getting money at the old world country, which the plots were influential type people.
Yeah.
You know, and they got it from somewhere.
Yeah.
They were business people, they were horse people, and I think they had the influence and the means to be able to and I'm not saying at all they kept all the genetics within those five dogs. I'm with Michael.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's saying that, but exaggerated fairy tale version of the story.
The reason that it's an Americana story is because of the deep, rich history. It's the first, it's a North Carolina state dog. It's you know, there's mountains named after the Plott family.
Yeah.
It just fits Americana.
That was my whole thing.
You look at the Walker dog and you can talk about George Washington, you know?
Yeah.
So there's
not the same dogs.
They're not the same dog, but they are the dogs where our Treme Walkers came from when you trace it backwards.
Brent, what about the whole story was most important to you?
Which
came from the English Foxhound.
Yeah, but it was a black and tan.
I don't want to have that conversation. Brent, what was the most thing that what stood out to you most? And you probably wouldn't have known that story much about it.
No,
would you?
Very little of it had I ever heard. But also, the longer I listened to it, I could care less which story was true.
Right, right.
What fascinated me was the family. And that's what is so rich in it. And what's so American to me is they can trace it back to that family so far. And everyone was all in on these dogs, regardless of where they came from. Once they got it started, they stayed with it. And it was father and son and grandson and grandson and grandson and nephew and uncle and everybody. And there's still folks over there right now spelling their last name Plott, and they've got those dogs in the front yard. And to me, that is the absolute coolest thing. This would be a heck of a movie. This would beat Old Yeller to death.
Yeah.
It was an awesome story. My favorite part of the whole thing was when you were riding with Bob in the beginning, and he was saying, you know, they were here, and this was his house.
Yeah.
That was awesome. The story of them bringing those dogs and it following them through history and the pride that they would have had is just awesome. I had seven generations of the same females starting seven generations ago, and they were it for me. And they would feel the exact same way. But could you imagine, not seven generations ago, but when did they bring the dogs over? 1750. If you breed a female, most of the time around 2 or 3 years old, you're looking at 100 generations of dogs.
Yeah.
So they have 100 generations of those dogs. That's awesome.
You know, to me, the most, like, if you're talking about how the Plott story is different, and not that we're trying to say it's better than, I've had many people already say, you should do one of these on the Walker breed. And I'm sure we could. I mean,
as interesting, though.
Well, but that's what, I think, to me, being an adult, and I got into Plotts roughly 9 years ago. That's kind of when I was introduced. So I was an adult, and it was like my eyes popped open when I went and saw Roy Clark and Tracy and Ben Jones and Curtis Walker. And who are some of the, I mean, Mark Dufresne up in Maine and Dan Wagner and,
Ira
Jones. Oh, can't forget Ira.
Yeah.
Ricky Reinhart, all the guys that I know over there, and a bunch of people are going to get upset if I don't start naming their names, Chris. Who am I missing that I know? there's these incredible Plott people that just are deep in it. I mean, they just bleed Plott. And it's such a regional phenomenon. That's, to me, what's the coolest part of it. The whole thing is that it happened in a very small geographic area and was isolated geographically for basically 150 years.
And
then it just... exploded.
I mean, that was put through the lens of, this is a geographic region that has been sort of a national joke. Like, look at those poor people. They've got nothing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
to be like, this thing that I can take pride in that comes from here, that is my thing and is now nationally recognized as the best at what it does.
Yeah.
I think that sort of incongruency or seeming incongruency
You're foreshadowing into the next episode, Isaac.
I'll shut it down. You hadn't even
heard it.
I know.
No, that, for real, we talk about how that these people didn't have much, but this is something they had.
Yeah.
Well,
valuable. That's why it became so valuable.
They were valuable enough to be hauled out to places like Oregon when the timber trade took off in Oregon. These Appalachians who had been cutting chestnuts and all this other stuff for generations, it's like, yeah, we can cut down big trees. When they went, they took their dogs.
Yeah.
You know, they, and that's how the Brendel dogs end up in the
and
Northwest.
Today, the plot is all over. I mean, you go to Wisconsin and Michigan, they're big hubs for
Everett
plots.
Everett Weems lived in Illinois.
He was a big coon hunter.
Yep. But
and,
he also
big
bred,
game, big game.
Bred some of the best big game dogs. You got Salmon River dogs that Doc Smith had out in Salmon, Idaho.
Yeah, yeah. What, Chris, give me kind of like a tour of the plot geographically. We're not going to hit everybody, so if you're offended by this, then I'm sorry. But like,
it's Chris's
fault. My buddy, my dear friend of our family, the Clarks in East Tennessee, Laurel Mountain plots.
Yeah.
Just name some of them. There's no way we can name them all.
Well, Everett ended up taking, you know, dogs and getting them in Illinois, and those were the Weems bred dogs. And
Weems
then you
bred
had
plots.
Yeah, Weems bred, and then those turned into Swampland dogs and Mike Colley's
Swampland,
Bayou
Mike Colley, Louisiana.
And then you got, well, Swampland was Leroy Hogg in Ferdinand, Indiana.
That's right.
Mike Colley ends up with the Bayou Cajun plots that he's been breeding on for years. You've got the Houston Valley plots in eastern Tennessee.
Tracy and
you got
Ben.
The Salmon River plots that were out in the Salmon River country. You get the Bluff Creek plots in Oklahoma or Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was one of those
and
deals.
Pocahontas and West Virginia plots.
You got
Curtis Walker.
You've got the Redwood plots that Jeff Koons kind of inherited from his uncle. And developed into highly skilled dogs. You got the Sarge bred plots from Ohio.
Brandenburg,
that was an older.
Good enough. I mean, just the point is that
widespread.
That inside of the plot world, there's these little narrow channels, and people just go nuts over them. I mean, people are looking for certain dogs that are bred in certain ways. And just to the average person, to be like, it's just a plot. But there's these real specific things connected to real specific people, and it's just kind of neat.
Do these dogs start to get different looks?
Yeah, a real student of the plot breed will be able to tell. You know, Brandenburger plots were a little bigger and a little houndier looking than what some other, and a real good person, better than I am, can walk through plot days and say, well, that's a. You know, that's a Pocahontas, and that's a brand, you know, this is that.
They do have a look. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I love
you get a trained eye for them.
I love hounds, all of them. And I've never really paid much attention to plots because, you know, there's not very many around here.
Yeah.
But undeniably, they have the best backstory of any of them.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. There's none of the rest of these hounds. So, you know, you have blue ticks with the Vaughns and those guys, and you have the Walker dogs with the Giddings up there, and there's several different, but none of them have the type of story that a plot hound has.
Yeah, that's why I like them. Dad, what stood out to you, just like in the whole story, like what surprised you, what stood out?
Well, it's amazing that a family name could be attached to those dogs for so long, and I like to play the game of who's right. Was it the two boys coming from Germany? Was it George family coming over? So you made a compelling argument. You guys just really did a great job. My argument would be that this was a smart, successful family. You got a guy here that wrote a book.
Yeah.
I trust Oral. You know, they couldn't find documentation to support Oral. But, I mean, these are brilliant people. Successful people, you don't see the Newcomb name all over the world. I mean, these guys, there's something special about these plot people. And they're not going to pass down lies. I mean, George tells his boy Henry. Henry tells Monty. Monty tells John. And it goes up to your buddy Bob.
Right.
That's not too far back.
Yeah.
You know, so
you're saying it's not, they didn't just fabricate an outright lie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I admit that it could be the other way. I mean, but
well, that's a big question that has to be answered.
Yeah.
Was there a family reunion when they're like, back in the 1800s, before they knew there was going to be an internet or anybody was going to care.
We're going to get our stories straight.
Here's what we're going to do, boys.
Well, hey, Moses wrote the book of Genesis thousands of years after the Garden of Eden. So do you believe that or not?
There you go.
If you can't believe that, then the plot story probably isn't for you.
Well, the likelihood is. It's probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
It, just like any other story, it's probably a little bit of both.
Yeah, yeah.
And in all fairness to John or Mr. Jackson.
John Jackson.
I don't feel like I felt like he was very measured in his response. It was more 100%. Of, I could not find document. Yeah.
Yeah.
He wasn't. Yeah. I didn't feel like it was too antagonistic or aggressive.
Yeah. And no doubt. Well, I tried to make it clear too that, you know, one option would be that this family, just to go along with what you said, were so sharp, dominant socially, successful, that maybe not even with intentionality, the plot name just got attached to them.
Right.
And that's kind of what John Jackson says. And it wasn't like they did this as some kind of conspiracy. It just happened on its own, you know, and it emerges the plot hound, but really the bigger web was much bigger in many other families. And in theory, and this is an exaggerated thing, but in theory, there could have been some other family that was as involved but not as vocal. I mean, that's kind of the idea, which there's no evidence that really supports that. Like, there was not another dominant family. And what my friend, I'm not going to say his name because he might feel like he's going to get in trouble. He told me, a friend of ours, Chris, over in Appalachia, that's a big plot man. He said, Clay, can you imagine a family in Appalachia that was raising dogs, two families raising dogs, break it down, two families raising dogs that were the same and they'd been working together, and one family gets to name the dog after their family? He said, don't you think the other family would be throwing a fit?
Oh, yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like, as if the plots came in and, like, swooped in to get all the glory for this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, 100%.
And this guy was like, no. He said, he basically was like, I think they got it honest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You'd hear documentation of the other family going, hold up.
Yeah.
Those are our dogs.
This is the Jones dog. Yeah.
I can tell you that even within an established breed, you know, breeding for traits, breeding for conformation, breeding for color and things like that, it's tough to do by yourself. Mm-hmm. Even your own family, you're going to need a network of people.
Yes.
So that would be a regional thing for Appalachia at the time. You know, there's other people in the community that needed bear dogs, and the plots had the dogs, but when it comes back to it, and now I've got to breed the next generation of dog, it's like, is that a plot? Well, I don't know if it's a plot dog or not. Well, it looks like a plot, and it's a really good bear dog. It's going to fit into this program. We can make this work. You know, that dog's got traits that I like, so he's not going to upset the apple cart here. So I really like him. Let's add him. That's just that's a natural development of whether it's cattle, breed, dog, sheep, or whatever. You know,
and undoubtedly that happened.
And at some point, it got to the point where, you know, Vaughn, a few generations later, he already had his breed type, he already had his standard. Isaiah Kidd, all those guys, they all had that breed standard and stuff, and so they didn't breed outside of it. Their gene pool was big enough where they could stay within the breed type, and boom, 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 it just exploded.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't explode, but they're still the most rare.
I was going to bring up, I had somebody that got on to me they said I bashed Ford trucks. When I said, it's like building a Ford truck. We needed some overseas parts, but make it American made. And they thought it was like a punch to Ford.
Oh, really? Ford. That's crazy.
I could have said anything. I could have used any single. I thought it was funny, though.
I was triggered.
Somebody was triggered on that. That was funny. What other thoughts? Yeah, I have been working on this in ways for a long, long time. I did those interviews 2 years ago, and I actually didn't.
You sounded younger.
Yeah, I sounded younger. Mm-hmm. Wasn't as smart, though.
No, not even close.
But I... It was a lot of fun, and I think people that aren't even into hounds could listen to it because it really wasn't about.
No, it was a family story.
It's Americana. Yeah. It's American history, and it's a legacy.
Yeah,
and it's you find a lot of value in it if you and all you got to do is look. Is just barely look under the surface of it. I know you've heard me talk about, and I've talked about on my podcast about my dad's squirrel, the squirrel dogs in my family. Mm-hmm. It started with my great grandfather. Well, it ended with me and my brother. We have no more of them. They're right. gone. Right. There will never be any more of those dogs. And that is what's so cool about it to me. And even emotional when I listen to it and think about all of that history with that family.
Yeah.
There's more. I can't wait for the rest of it.
I don't think people, including me, understand the dedication it takes to have a generational line of hounds.
That's what I was fixing to say. It's an incredible amount of work. I had seven generations of females all mm-hmm. the way back. I didn't feel like breeding for a little while, and I didn't. And the last one died the day that Heck was born. And that's it. They're gone. There isn't any more of them.
Yeah.
That's it.
And to think going back that many it just takes a ton of intentionality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How many plots do you have, Chris, right now?
I've got two right now.
Two?
Yeah, I've just got two.
Yeah. What's mm-hmm. their breeding?
They're Bayou Cajun plots. My collie's stuff.
Yeah, good.
Yep.
Well, I am big time in the market for a plot female. I've decided, I told these guys, so this is funny, and this will give you a little bit of insight as we close down into the way people think about these things, is, so my good plot female that I had, Fern, Newcomb's Ozark BC Fern, BC stands for Bluff Creek, got it from Steve Hurd. She was all I needed in a coon dog, I if I had another one like her for the rest of my life, I'd be happy. That doesn't mean she was good. Doesn't mean she was bad. I just liked her.
That's good enough.
She died last winter. She died. Plot coon dogs are hard to find. I mean, it's not that hard to like get a plot, but I tried to replace her for 5 years before she died. Like I got.
I told you all plots about that.
And got rid of, went through, I think, four different dogs. And I even went as far as to hunt a walker dog. Michael had a dog.
That's it, I'm done.
Yeah. I hunted a dog for a couple of days that Michael had that was a fine hound. I mean, probably better than any hound I've ever handled. And what I learned was I didn't want a walker dog. I thought I wanted a coon dog. I didn't really want a coon dog.
You want a plot dog.
I wanted a plot coon dog. Because I actually trial hunted another walker during this summer. And a guy, you know, just a friend of mine, had a dog. Said, you know, I hunted it three nights and just gave it back to him. And it wasn't the dog's fault. I just was kind of like, yeah, that was kind of the dog's fault. Didn't do it for me.
You like what you like.
And it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think it probably bumfuzzled my two dear walker friends here. They're like, hey, Clay, I thought you wanted a coon dog.
Yeah. No,
here you go.
I've always known you're weird.
You know why I got a walker dog? Because the first dog I got was a walker dog.
Yeah. If that had happened to me, that's the way I'd have been. Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that there's a lot of really nice dogs out there of all colors. I mean, there really are. Plots, you take like the Redwood line of plots, and you take like Johnny Hager from West Virginia, and he can compete just with anybody. You know he's going to be there. At least you're going to know he was there anyway.
Yeah.
And Evan Workman and Jeff Koons and now, you know, they're out there. But I always get tickled out of these guys that are, you know, they're hunting a walker or something like this, and they're like, yeah, I always thought I'd try a plot sometime. It's like, man, you don't have enough buy-in. It's like, no, that's not the way this works. You got to have total buy-in.
Commitment.
It's like likened to deer hunt. And think, oh, I think I'll pick up a flintlock and go out and shoot a deer with it. You got to be more invested in it than that.
A good way to say it.
It's not easy. I'm not even saying you're smart. I'm just saying it's not, you know.
Yeah, yeah. My life would be easier. I could go. I bet money. We should probably do it. I bet today, Dad. I bet I could buy 5 Walker dogs in the state of Arkansas that we could take out tonight and go tree-a-coon.
And tree-a-coon, I guarantee
in the next
it.
4 hours, I'd make 4 or 5 calls, and I could get a good 3-year-old dog if I had the money. I mean,
oh, you get it.
You do, yeah. Look at that.
I'll sell you one when this is over.
yeah.
And I know what did a coon the same, dog
if
is.
If I had 10 grand. And you said, Clay, go find you a good 2-year-old plot female coon dog. I'd be like, okay.
Which direction do I go?
I mean, they might be out there, and money talks. I might be able to pry one out of somebody.
Though? Why? Just because they're more big game hounds is what.
Well, no,
towards
man. This, how long are we gonna make this podcast?
This is what I made in part. I said this in a post on Instagram. I made and tagged Brent Reeves. There's 100 walkers to every 1 plot, at maybe more, maybe 1,000 walkers. Like if you actually did the population dynamics on the breed of dog, let's just say there's 100 to 1. If I give you 100 tries to throw a beanbag through a hole and I get 1, you're gonna win
every
single time. Mm-hmm. And my point is that. Because me and you have joked, Brent, and I've said that to Brent before, and I'm pretty sure he was like, well, why do you think there's 100 walkers?
Exactly.
Because they're good and people want them. I don't think that logic is not entirely true, because it all has to do with access. And the walker you couldn't even get plots till the 1940s.
Walker dogs are good entry-level dogs for people that need them.
Yeah, get to the top
tier.
No.
This is not degrading to walkers. I'm just saying – It's not that simple.
No.
And so they're just a smaller pool. They're primarily big game dogs. It's just like go right now and try to find a 6-week-old plot pup.
When we were talking earlier, I said plots are different, and they are. And, in 1946, UKC decided to recognize them as a hound. And it had some value for historical preservation and records keeping and stuff like that. But at that point, now you're allowed to go hunt them in UKC night hunts and different. So there's even a lot of strife within the plot breed, breeders and fanciers between big game bred and coon bred dog,
right.
coon dog type stuff.
Yeah.
There's that kind of strife. There's strife. Well, he's a good bear dog, but. Or he's a good hog dog, but they're not good. They're too hard for bear. You get them killed on bear. You can just go on and on and on. You can make all kinds of stuff. So the reason walkers are better is because people have one goal in mind, and that's to breed a good coon dog.
Yeah.
Plot breeders want hog dogs. They want utilitarian dogs. They want bear dogs. They want coon dogs. They want.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Walker breeders are like, we're going to tree coons with this dog, and we're going to win world championships, and we're going to win a lot of them. And
yep.
And that's what they do.
And, Dad, that's the walker dominates the hound world. I mean, dominates. Like, I don't know. The big world championship hunts, how many have not been walkers in the last 20 years? I mean, there's been some.
There's been a few, maybe
a blue tick here and there, maybe.
No, but not in UKC. Blue ticks never won the UKC world.
Okay. Right? But anyway, the walker is like the dog that you have if you're a coon dog guy. But so, and that's what Brent's got.
Yep.
You had a blue tick as a kid, didn't you?
Yeah. My first dogs were blue ticks. Mm-hmm.
I was saying the blue ticks won some ACHA world hunts, didn't they?
Yeah. Yep.
And there was a plot that won the world one time in the 80s, right?
Yep.
That was like Arkansas Razorbacks, 1994. NCAA champs, Corliss Williamson, Scotty Thurman, beat Duke.
That's right.
1994, go Hogs, right?
Right.
That's
amen,
the
brother.
One thing we've got in this whole state. Like our whole history.
We got basketball and we got almost baseball.
Well, so, that's like the plots. When was 1988 ball. That yeah. dog won the world championship?
It was 86.
They won the PKC World one time, too.
Yep. They won the PKC World. Yep.
So, we got a few bright spots in the past.
That's good.
But we do have a good story.
Yeah, John Walkup won it, PKC, and
Sarge.
Spud Reynolds and Jim Canham won it with Sizzling Heat in the UKC World Hunt.
Mm. I guess I could use this platform to my advantage to try to appeal to some of these good plot coon man.
I thought that was the only reason you were doing this.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah,
this
right.
whole thing has been a machination.
Well, see,
that
I've
somebody,
hunted
please.
The dog, Fern, the dog that you and Michael have both hunted with.
Mm, yeah, she was a good
one. Well, she was not. She was the only coon dog. I mean, almost all those dogs went to be lion and bear and hog dogs.
Yeah, but like, Fern could have been as good a coon dog as there is. Fern's little holes that she had was because of you.
No doubt.
So it was stuff that you let her do that was
sure.
okay with you. So
sure.
other than that,
sure.
street coon's as good as any dog I've ever seen.
Yep.
So
you're being generous. He doesn't say that when I'm not around.
No, yeah. he does. Yeah. That's the truth. I've seen
well,
it. He saw it.
I've been around some top plot coon dogs. I mean, they're out there, but they're hard to. They're just hard to get your hands on.
Yeah. Yep. Well, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, just one thought. I can't remember which one it was, but one of those boys, Mont, or his boy.
Montreville.
Yeah. Said he would never have a bathroom inside a house
yeah.
he was living in.
Yeah.
I thought about that two different times today, just driving down the road going,
yeah.
I mean, there is
that
a
makes
logic
a lot
to it.
Of sense.
He wasn't the only one in that time period that thought that
oh.
either. That was a... Yeah, I'm not.
That was. I
the
left
house.
That in there because it was
yeah.
such a little yeah. nugget. Yeah, he said. I will. He didn't have an indoor bathroom until like the 1940s.
Yeah.
Because he said, I will never go to the bathroom in my house. How okay. crazy are you? That was good. Now that plot history over there. Golly, if you're ever in Western North Carolina, Maggie Valley, Haywood, I know you've seen all the sites, Chris. Mm-hmm. There's a really neat historical marker put up by the state of North Carolina that looks over the Plot Balsam Range, and it has it's a big bronze, mm-hmm. you know, about the half the size of a truck hood that has the story of the Plot Hound. You know,
oh,
it says
cool.
that the Plots, they lived here, they hunted here, they did this. Really cool. And then Bob just gave me the tour. Man, one day, I mean, I'll realize what a unique thing I had spending the day a lot more than that with Bob Plott over there. Such a neat guy. And, yeah.
The cabin in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Those need to be preserved, if nothing, in really good photography and put it somewhere on display. I mean,
yeah.
I can't believe those two places are just... Maybe
well,
they're not being neglected.
Well, listen to this. So, Mont Plott's house... That was built in like 1903. Yeah, 1903.
Yep.
Somebody has, it's not in the Plott family anymore. Somebody has bought that and they've fixed it up and it's a beautiful home. Probably worth a ton of money. They kept it classic though. They held true. Just imagine a really nice home that's been renovated but still holds the kind of the traditional looks and styles. And so me and Bob went to this man's house, knocked on the door. Bob knew him, and he's like, oh, Bob. And he's like, hey, these are Plott men. They want to see, you know, Mont's old house. And he took us all through the house, and real neat. And the cabin is surprisingly still intact. They've done a good job of keeping it up, but it's not public. I mean, it's not like you can go there and knock on this guy's door, you know, and it's very private, and, you know, they're not, like, telling you where it's at. But, yeah, it's a massive piece of history.
I think the photography of it should be out for the public to see.
And it is somewhere. Well, there's pictures of
okay.
all that in Bob's
yeah.
book.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's
great,
the name of that
story.
Again?
Strike and Stay, The Story of the Plot Hound. Yeah, man, support old Bob. He's a great writer. He's done a lot of writing in Southern mm-hmm. Appalachia. He's got a stack of great
these
history
are Southern
books.
Highlands? Isn't that one of his? Or was it the Legendary Hunters of the Southern Highlands?
Yeah, that's it.
That's another
there's
book.
There's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
There's some on the railroads and
yep.
different things. But, yeah, this has been great. Thank you, Chris, for coming from Indiana.
Oh, it was my
Amen.
Honor.
Very
Michael,
good, Chris.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
From Mike. South Arkansas, Sunspot Lights, Southern-ish Arkansas.
Where?
Southern-ish.
Grady?
No. McRae.
North Central.
Okay.
Wherever. Okay. Somewhere.
I was just going to let him roll with
you
it.
Somewhere. He lives somewhere down there.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Isaac, good to have you. Brent, good to have you.
Gotcha.
Hey, Meat Eater's got a bunch of Black Friday sales. First Light. If you want to take advantage of of these big companies. Now's your time. Now's your time. Thank you, guys.
You bet.
Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you oughta, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools. It's pre-seasoned with food-safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. This griddle heats evenly edge to edge, reaching all the way up to 500 degrees. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate rust-resistant griddle. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.